Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of My Property World. Today, we're looking at the property world of Greg Chappell. Greg is a friend of mine. He's involved in the rugby club that I coach at in London, Belsize Park. And he's got a fascinating story around property, construction, and the English wine industry. Now, Greg Chappell is a name that's probably best known to the older listeners as a former Australian cricketer that was involved in a poor incidence of sportsmanship. So on that note, Greg Chappell, the Cotswolds cricketer, as opposed to the Australian cricketer, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Will. It's good to speak to you.
So, Greg, your former career was within big construction. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you were doing and how you got into it and what sort of stuff you were up to?
So I got into construction from an interest in property. I did a law with environmental sciences degree at Northumbria University, and some of the modules I did best at were planning and development law, health and safety modules, things that were all particularly relevant to the property market. And after university, I was at a careers fair at the law school, and there was a local surveying firm that were looking for summer interns. So I went and I did an internship with a local surveying firm, land agency up in Northumberland. And whilst I was there, I was working on planning applications for barns, small developments of houses, and things that I generally found very interesting. At the same time, I was looking for a graduate role, something based where I was in Newcastle, because I enjoyed living in there in Newcastle at the time, and involved in the property sector, because that's what I had a keen interest in. I applied to the Barratt Developments Aspire graduate program and was accepted, but they didn't have any vacancies in Newcastle, so they recommended that I relocate down to Essex and work in their Eastern Counties division. The Aspire program, for any graduates out there listening, and I'm not paid or endorsed by Barratt for saying this, but I think probably the other top big house builders offer similar schemes. It's a fantastic entry into the property market. So what I was on a two-year graduate program. The first year was 6 2-month rotations around every different department of the business, so you get a full holistic understanding of the development process. And then the second year was sort of you pick one of those disciplines and then you focus on that and you follow it through. And at the end of the 2 years, there should be a job waiting for you if you've done everything correctly. So I thoroughly enjoyed the first year of rotations. The things I enjoyed the most were site management, being actually out in the fields, helping the construction teams build these homes. I wanted to make sure I got a full understanding and the respect of the subbies on site. So I was helping load out the bricks, helping the scaffolders, doing whatever I could to assist the trades on site whenever the site manager would allow me to do so. And it got me a really good understanding of how buildings are put together. It's very easy to sit in a site manager's office and just manage the health and safety and not really focus on the construction elements. I worked with a really, really great site manager called Trevor Bowden, who actually won a a Pride in the Job award from the NHBC for his site. And it's a site that my brother actually bought a house on, and it's a really, really lovely development in Norfolk. So I did the 12 months of rotations through all the different departments. The other department I really enjoyed was the land team. So I'd worked with a rural land agency on planning permissions, and I'd done well with planning law at university. And so at the end of my 2 years, at the end of my 1 year of rotations, there was an opening to become a land graduate in the land team. That was working under Matt Ward, who was the land director at the time at Barratt and was a fantastic manager. And I really enjoyed working as part of that land team for the following year, helping to get some sites acquired and help manage some planning applications that were going through the process. Unfortunately, at the end of that year's trading, when it came to the end of the graduate program, the Barratt Land Bank for the Eastern Counties was actually full. So they had enough sites in the pipeline that they weren't actively buying or promoting any more land at that time. So there were a few people within the land team who moved on to competitors who were seeking new sites. There was sort of a question as to whether or not there would be a position in the land team for a graduate turning into a junior land manager.
Yeah, some scale, how many people would have been in that particular land team?
So at the peak, we had probably about 8 people. There was myself and another assistant land buyer. And then there were some senior land buyers, some land buyers, a planning manager and a planning assistant. So there's about 8 to 10 people working in the land team acquiring sites. And the Eastern Counties team was quite large. It covered Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, a little bit of the edges of London, but mainly that was left to the London development teams, and Cambridgeshire. So the flagship site for the region was the Truckton Meadows development, which is a huge multi-award winning development on the edge of Cambridge by the M11. So after the graduate program had finished, I was asked if land was certainly something I was interested in. At the same time within the business, the estimator for the commercial team was moving on to a new role. And I'd spent all of my time working in the land team quite closely with him on the viabilities of whether or not schemes would work. And a major part of land buying, as anyone listening to this podcast will know, is all about, does it make any money? What's the profit margin? Is it going to hit target returns? What's the work in progress, sort of cash flow? When are we going to get our money back? What's the ROCE? So I spent a lot of time working with the estimator, and he'd moved on, as I said. And the land team was drying up. So I had a conversation with the commercial director, who said, look, you've been involved in this. We've got a month or two before the estimator goes. How do you fancy having a crack at it? And it was an opportunity that sort of fit the circumstance at the time. The team in the commercial department were fantastic. They were a huge amount of fun. And it sort of fit the bill for me at that stage in my career. We weren't buying any land, so it didn't make sense to be in a land team. But we had all of the valuations and the costings of all of the ongoing sites, all of the replans, and it worked really well. So I sort of fell into estimating. I was basically dropped into it as a graduate on my own. There were no other estimators in the team. I was working with the quantity surveyors and very, very close with the commercial director, Andy Powell, who was a fantastic bloke to work for. He's now at Taylor Wimpey Essex and doing great things, I'm sure. He sort of gave me a lot of support and encouragement and helped me through that role. And then I was the estimator, sole estimator there for a couple of years. And then as we sort of opened up the land bank and said, okay, we're going to grow the division. We're going to develop more houses a year.
So, just for the listeners' benefit, roughly when is this in terms of what year?
So that's a very good question. The concept of time has really been muddled by the pandemic, hasn't it? It feels like life has sort of, the last year has lasted maybe 3 or 4 years. So Barratt Homes, I probably started there We're probably talking 2016 to 2018 when I was the estimator at Barrett, Eastern Counties. That makes sense. No, it was sort of, yeah, till 2019. I was there till August 19. No. Yes, I was there till August 19. And by the time I left Eastern Counties, I had recruited an assistant estimator, a young lad straight out of college, and he was helping. And it was a fantastic place to be. We were developing a lot of schemes. There were a lot of jobs on. It was a huge amount of work and responsibility. And it was a really good period in my career. But my career, the head offices...
Scale of works, number of projects, if you hit two, just give us a little bit of a flavour.
So we worked on mainly developments of 100 units upwards, up to 1,000 unit developments. So there were some really big schemes we worked on. There was a scheme in North Ambridge, which I think was, it was in the region of 500 units. Up in Norfolk, I had a development for 259 units that we did the cost plans for and got onto the site. So that was really nice. So that was the extension, the second phase of the site that I'd worked on as an assistant site manager. So it was nice to see every aspect of that, from finishing the units on phase one to acquiring the site for phase two, going to planning and getting planning for it, and then getting back on site. And now when I go and visit my brother, I get to really appreciate the work that we did in the cost plan stage and the estimating and the tenders, because you can see all of that with the guys on site and the amazing houses that are being built. So we had many jobs, probably had about 12 active jobs at any one time, and we were looking to keep that going. So we were acquiring new sites, anything with 100 units or up. If it was less than 100 units, it might come into consideration, but it would have to be in an extremely desirable location, sort of next to major trunk roads or train stations with access into London. So we had probably 12 active jobs with valuations and cost planning and savings. We were going through and looking at materials. Once we'd achieved planning, we'd look at seeing if we could optimize what we'd got and make material substitutions in reaction to market trends. So if a certain brick became unavailable or difficult to achieve, can we do a material substitution? And actually, can we do it with something a little bit more cost effective and make a bit more margin on the project?
And in terms of that front end of projects, what do you think larger developers do well that smaller developers would be advised to contemplate?
That's an interesting question. So I think the fact that larger developers have the established relationships with the promoters of the world who have got the big sites, is the access to big sites, I think, that is really sort of the future of developing. And for the big house builders, at least, I think they see it more as a quicker way of getting through a job and getting paid. So recently, anyone who's driving around, you may have seen a lot of Barrett jobs will be dual branded. There'll be a Barrett outlet and a David Wilson outlet. So they've got two different brands on the same site, which means they can build it twice as quick and sell it twice as quick to two different markets. The David Wilson homes being slightly larger and executive, and the Barrett homes being an everyman's home. It means that they've got a quicker cash flow and a quicker return. That would be quite difficult, I think, for a smaller developer, because, you know, there's a lot of cost to go into setting up two compounds, to have two build teams, to have two sets of contracts to get through a job. If you were only developing 50 houses, those sort of overheads would be prohibitive to get your return. You're not going to get the savings by putting those overheads into burning through your sales and build quicker. So I think scalability is one of the best options for larger developers. Their ability to gear up a project so that they can be building twice as fast, selling twice as fast. By the same token, if the economy shrinks and demand comes down, then they can slow that down by they could close one of those site offices and site teams and sales offices, and they could just build it all out of one set of overheads. So I think that flexibility for a larger developer on a bigger scheme is really quite useful in terms of economic surety. I'd struggle to see how you could get that sort of flexibility in a smaller scheme, because if you've bought a development of 20, 30 houses, and you know something bad happens and demand goes through the floor, then there's not much you can do other than stop building, and you're not really going to be able to do that because you've got contracts, and if you sit on them, then the price is only going to go one way. I think scale is fantastic. Also, the purchasing power of people like Taylor Wimpey, David Wilson, Vistry Homes. If they're building 15,000 homes a year across the country, they're buying, I don't know, 30, 40,000 toilets. Those toilets are going to come in at a price that no small independent contractor is going to get anywhere near. And the rebates that they can have with their suppliers as well. Those are the real benefits of scaling up and becoming a medium or larger size developer.
And in terms of what sort of metrics or insights do you think are things that are perhaps commonplace in larger, more professional organisations versus smaller aspiring organisations within development?
Interesting question. I'm not sure, because I've only worked on my personal development projects and at the larger end of development. So I don't really fully understand the metrics used by smaller developers. I mean, pound per square foot in development for me was one of the largest metrics, whether that was sales rate or build cost. So it's how much does it cost us to build per square foot? How much are we selling it for? What's the difference? How much does that convert to for percentage profit margin? Those were the main things we were looking at when we were building a cost plan. It was how much it cost to build, how much it cost to sell, what's the difference, how much money? Those were, it didn't matter how many things you measured, those were the things that mattered.
And in the midst of this, your own personal property journey started evolving. So what was the beginning of that? And
So the beginning of that was
out of the you know, the Barretts of this world into where your, you know, first time buyer and then investor and
I did it the other way around. So we did it the other way around. Wasn't a first time buyer in the traditional sense, in that I was living in Essex, working in Essex, and they were heavily inflated house prices due to the proximity to London. And they were sort of a one bedroom flat by the station where I'd want to be was out of reach for someone on a graduate scheme salary. So we looked around and we were able to find a Regency beautiful grade two listed apartment that was in a really poor condition in Cheltenham. And we were able to pick that up and renovate that on a buy to let deal, because we had enough money saved to put the deposit down on something sub £100,000, but we couldn't have the money, we didn't have the money to put together to put the deposit down on a 250 grand flat in Chelmsford. And Chelmsford was a good place to be in terms of my career at Barrett, but it was never sort of home for me. I would spend my weekends traveling to Newcastle to see my partner Meg. I'd spend my weekends traveling home to Norfolk, into London to see my friends, or out to the West Country to see other family. So it wasn't somewhere where I really wanted to be based. So London was always part of the journey, and we knew we were going to start living in London, but London, worse than Essex, would be prohibitively expensive to get on the ladder. So
and
we bought an investment property.
Just rewinding to that first purchase, tell us a little bit about that. How did you?
Yeah, so I'm coming on to that. So we bought.
What were the stages to get to the other site?
So we have a connection to Cheltenham. For those that have never been, it's a beautiful town. It's got a lot going on. It has a thriving festival scene throughout the year. It's a really beautiful place to be, and it's well connected in terms of the West Country. So we started looking there for a buy-to-let because we knew we weren't going to get on the ladder for a residential purchase. And we found this gorgeous little mansion house that had been subdivided into flats, and the top floor flat was in a squalid state and had a very difficult sitting tenant. That was putting a lot of people off, and that was really our opportunity to get in there. So we were so in love with the outside of the building and the photos that we'd seen online. We didn't mind that the first couple of times we turned up for viewings, we were denied access by the tenant, and we just had to look from the outside. We eventually were able to view the property. It was in a bit of squalor. There was a gentleman that was living on a mattress on the floor. There was rotting food everywhere. And it was just in a generally poor state. I think the building had been subdivided by a social housing organization in the 60s or 70s. And not much had been changed or updated in this particular flat since then. So we were able to secure that for a really, really good price. And we spent a little bit of money on it. We basically took down all of the internal partitions because it had been originally one room. And it was a studio apartment, but it was relatively sizable. And we were able to reconfigure it, reduce the size of the bathroom, and remodel it to be an open plan kitchen living room, and we were able to turn it into a really nice one bedroom flat, and that released a huge amount of equity, which was fantastic. It was a pretty quick turnaround in terms of the works, and not a huge amount of outlay, but we were able to add probably 60-65% of the value of the property back on by spending 20%. So we had a really good return on the work we did there. And that was our first purchase, and we were really happy with that because we, as I said before, we didn't know where we wanted to be living. I was living in Essex, my partner was still up in Newcastle, and that was absolutely fine for the period. So I was still in Chelmsford living, working for Barratt. When my partner moved down to London, it wasn't long before I followed into London, and I continued the commute out to Essex by car for another year and a half. That was probably the motivating factor for me to leave Barratt. I didn't really pursue the channels of transferring to Barratt London because I wasn't sure of how the estimating was done there, and there were many different reasons why, but also I think the main reason I didn't pursue transferring was anyone who's worked in cost management or estimating will be aware of just how rare estimators are. There are one or two left in the wild, and the money being thrown at them is a little bit silly. So I started flirting with the London network, and I ended up at London Developments, which was...
So I take it you didn't shy away from taking the silly money.
I thought it was an opportunity. I saw that I'd been a sole estimator. I'd gained a bit of experience. Probably still a little bit green, but who can honestly say they've taken a job confident that they're able to do all of it?
And what was your age at this point, roughly?
26, 27.
Okay, so you've got a renovation or purchase, a renovation, a number of units under your belt. You're talking in the thousands estimated.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and you're headed to the big smoke.
Yeah, so I knew I'd spent my career, I spent 5 years at Barratt. I knew how to build a standard masonry construction house. We'd built so many of them. I understood how to build a 3 or 4 story block of flats with concrete flooring, concrete frame, and then masonry externals. What I didn't understand was how to put together tower blocks of hundreds of homes and schemes with serious remediation issues. I thought, whilst I was at the stage in my career where if you go to any capital city in the world, they're building tower blocks. And if you want to be an international construction professional, then you've got to really understand that language. You can't spend the entirety of your career in standard masonry, 2-story, 3-story construction, and then start advising on multi-development platforms where you've got.
So this is heading straight, not just into the city, but into the really big stuff of residential construction.
So yeah, I needed to learn how to build up.
And what were the key differences that you picked up? So you moved away from Barrett. Who did you go to work for?
I went to work for Galliford Tribe Partnerships, which it was a social housing developer and development partner. And what had just been set up was a small sort of private partnership arm called London Development. And I went to join them because they were starting to do the private side of the social housing scheme. So maybe 20 or 30% of a scheme would be private and the rest would be all forward funded by social housing partners. So it was a really interesting model to switch from social housing being a dirty word sort of in Barrett and Eastern counties at certain times. You wanted to increase the amount of private housing on an estate and decrease the amount of social offered. I think that's changed a lot in all development terms because you can see it as guaranteed sales. And if it's 40% of your site, if 40% of your units are affordable, okay, they're going to be at half the cost of an open market dwelling, but it's a guaranteed sale that you don't have to pay any marketing costs for. You don't have to do any show homes. You've guaranteed that income. And actually the cost to fit it out is going to be much lower. So I think people in development and larger development are really becoming more interested in those social housing sort of partnerships because it can really de-risk a scheme and it can guarantee the viability of a scheme much better. So I joined London Developments as they were looking to progress and start building mixed tenure developments with a sort of reversed ratio of private to affordable. These would all be predominantly affordable led with a small amount of private that was going to make the money because it was in London. There was a premium attached to development.
Okay. And what what was the setup in terms of where did you sit in the organisation? Where was it based? What was the type of structure within the team? And how did you interact with the other parts of the business?
So it's a very interesting business and it was an interesting model in that Galliford were a contracting team and Galliford Tribe Partnerships were an out-and-out contracting business. They would tender for jobs and they would build them on behalf of people. It was something I'd never been involved with before. But developments was set up in the same way as a development firm that I'd sort of grown up in and understood how they ran. So it was interesting. The contracting team had some contracted out an estimator to the development team. And he was the lead on all of the tenders and all of the price cost plans that we were putting together for these development jobs. And I was sort of working with him. He was teaching me how to build or how to cost high-rise concrete frame buildings and all about piling and all of these complex remediation things. And it was fantastic and it was a really good learning curve. I sort of sat behind him in the development of cost plans and everything that I cost planned, he would check before submitting it to the development team to see whether or not it would stack up. And it was a good sort of 6 to 8 months starting that career and that juncture. There was a bit of confusion later on in the sort of Christmas of that year, because Galliford Tri Partnerships sold their partnerships business to Bovis Homes, because Bovis, as I was saying earlier, had recognised the importance of social housing in the future of development, de-risk your development by producing more social housing. Forward selling, you've got guaranteed income on a site, and then that leaves you more comfortable with the amount of private stock you have to shift. So Bovis bought the partnerships arm of Galliford Tri, and we were transferred across to them. So there was a little bit of uncertainty in the teams as to what was going to happen, and whether there was going to be any loss of staff due to the merger, and what the real sort of implications would be. So that was at Christmas last year.
Going into January 2020, basically.
When did the pandemic start? Was it in 2020? Yes.
End of March.
It was January 2020.
Came in.
Yeah, January 2020 was when the business was taken over by Bovis and there was the merger. And then obviously shortly after that, the pandemic hit. So I was very green in terms of the London construction market, and in terms of high-rise construction. Furlough followed for a short period, and then into the summer, life got a bit more back to normal, but by a bit more. I was living in West London, the offices were in Stratford, and the commute felt odd. There were people in the office who were shielding, it was a skeleton staff in the office, and London sort of became a different place to be. It was at this stage that we'd already started the purchase of this holiday let, and I sort of fell out of love with my job in the city and with that particular aspect of construction at that time, because when the pandemic hit, work on site stopped. There was a huge amount of uncertainty. All of the projects that were in the pipeline got halted. Why would you continue costing something that you might not buy? Because who knows how long this pandemic's going to be around. And there was a sort of inertia in the industry. And that made me start questioning where I was at personally. And that was when we decided that we had to switch the purchasing arrangements for the cottage to be a residential property.
So where is this cottage? So you had the one bed. You were in London, and then what's this holiday let? Tell us a bit about what possessed to investigate that and press ahead with a purchase.
In 2019, we were trying to purchase a property to live in London. And we had agreed a purchase and we were going through the motions. And as it often can do, there were issues with lease and who owns the loft space, because we were interested in this particular place because it had the potential for a loft conversion. The freeholder was the local authority. The downstairs was still in occupation by local authority tenants. And for that reason, they would not sort of entertain the sale of the loft space until they were no longer the freeholder. So it sort of made that purchase unviable. And then we looked into something different. We were aware of this cottage because it's in a village we know well, one that we frequently visit to see family. And it came onto the market just before the pandemic hit. And it was at that stage we became interested in it, because our London purchase had fallen through. We were probably already thinking about getting to a stage where we were looking outside of London. And the pandemic really geared that up. The reason we were buying is a holiday let, because we thought we could have it for a little escape for ourselves, continue renting in London and have a more affordable property outside that we could go to for weekends, but that could also be an addition to the portfolio and generate income for the rest of the year. So we were starting to think about how long we'd be in London. And that was when I started questioning whether I wanted to be in construction anymore. And that was when the conversations with the vineyard started about what was going to happen next. So I left Galliford, I left Bovis, Vistry Homes last August and joined Woodchester Valley Vineyard.
So the English wine industry.
Yes, the burgeoning now, English wine industry.
So where in the country are you based?
So the vineyard is out in the Cotswolds. It's in the South Cotswolds. We're halfway between Bath and Cheltenham. So we're just south of a little town called Stroud, which this year became named the best place to live in Britain by the Times. It's a lovely little market town.
People live there now. So
there's some great people that live around here. It's a really, really nice area to live in. It's a farmer's market on Friday and Saturday. There's a shambles market on a Monday, where you can buy all sorts of vintage paraphernalia. And it's really fantastic. Lots of little villages, amazing views, lots of traditional stone cottages, amazing pubs, great food. It's just a really nice place to be. So what with I call my millennial flap, which is where you get to approach 30 and you start thinking, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? Should I try something different? I didn't want to be at Vistry anymore, so I put my notice in. And I spoke to the vineyard manager and owners who I've known for a number of years and said, look, I know your harvest is coming up. There's been lots of talk in the press about there being a lack of foreign labour and there needs to be a land army to help the harvest of all sorts of different UK crops. Do you need a bit of help for the next couple of months to bring the grapes in for this year's vintage? And they said, yeah, we could really do with some help over the harvest. And also because of my sort of background in construction and sustainability, I worked on a lot of sustainable projects at Barratt, and I had that environmental credentials as part of my undergraduate degree. They said, whilst you're here, would you mind helping us look at our sustainability, our impact on the environment and all of our policies? So I signed up for a 2-month period whilst I sort of sorted my head out and worked out where I wanted to go next in the construction industry. And then I threw myself into the role I've got here at Woodchester Valley. As with many things in life, you sort of get into something and then there's all sorts of different aspects of it. So I was taken on a temporary basis, and I was taken on in September and sort of until the end of October when the grapes were all safely into the tanks becoming wine. That was when I'd sort of targeted my stage where I was going to start looking for another career. As these things go, by the time it got to the end of October, into November, things really started gearing up for Christmas and it got particularly busy. So I was asked if I wouldn't mind sticking around until the new year to help out with the busy period. And I basically jumped in the delivery van and got to drive all around the Cotswolds, which was a wonderful thing to do. It was beautifully scenic. And that seemed like it. And I sort of started putting it off and started thinking, okay, well, what am I going to do in the new year? We were still renovating the cottage at that point. We hadn't yet finished the project, so we wanted to stay in the locality. And it was in January that I was asked whether or not I'd consider becoming a full-time member of staff. The government and the industry are looking to recruit more English talent into UK wine. Like most farming, it's experiencing a skills crisis. Construction is exactly the same, experiencing a skills crisis. And so the government...
I would have thought that English people tend to be better at drinking wine and talking about wine than producing it. But you've got a great product out there now. And how do people actually get hold of it?
So we've got a fantastic...
And please go ahead, shameless plug, you know, contact details, websites. I'm a follower on Instagram, by the way. There's some amazing shots of the scenery and the vineyards and the beauty of the Cotswolds. But how do people get hold of it if they'd like to order the odd case here or there?
So if you want to come and see us, we're based down in Stroud. We have a cellar door shop on the A46 in Stroud, where you can buy the wine Monday to Saturday. We have tours and tastings that run Tuesday to Sunday. Our website, WorcesterValleyVineyard.co.uk. We've got national shipping, free local delivery.
WorcesterValley.co.uk.
WorcesterValleyVineyard.co.uk.
Right.
As you said, sort of follow us on Instagram. You can follow us on Twitter. It's sort of just get in touch. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
I've got to ask you this. We'll come back to finish off the cottage renovation and what's been happening there. But how have you found, like, you've gone from I suppose regional England into the city, and then out of the big smoke and into the beautiful rural England that the Cotswolds is. Talk us through each of those moves, because there were obviously motivations behind each of them, and what your experiences were.
So first move was up to Newcastle when I was 18. I grew up in Norfolk, and I just wanted to immerse myself in a different culture and a different area of the country. Lived up there for a number of years and fell in love with it, wanted to stay there. It was a job opportunity that took me to Essex, and actually being based in Essex wasn't too far from my family home in Norfolk, and it wasn't too far from London. So my friends who'd moved to London, I was able to go and visit them. My friends who were still at home, I was able to go and visit them. It was a really good base, albeit a long way from Newcastle, which was where my partner was. So I spent a lot of time on the M11 and the M1, heading up and down the country. Once my partner had moved to London and I was based in Essex, I was then doing a lot of driving back and forth. And actually, there was a lot more happening from my friendship group. I found this amazing rugby club, which is where we met, in Belsize Park. And London was a fantastic place to be. So London was a very easy move to make. Belsize was one of the best things I did in London, joining that rugby team. I've had some amazing experiences as part of Belsize. Been to places in the world I'd never consider going, like Moldova in Eastern Europe and Mozambique in Southern Africa, all made possible by the friends I made and the amazing organisation at the rugby club. Why did we move out of London? Well, we're sort of getting to stage where that was probably almost entirely due to the pandemic. Interestingly, when we completed on the cottage, we spoke to the local estate agent we'd bought it from, and they made 25 sales in the month that we completed. And of those 25 sales, 22 were to Londoners who were escaping the city. It was covered in the press that there's been a mass exodus from London of people who want that country life. We were very lucky when we were in London in that we were right next to Hampstead Heath and Regent's Park. So we had a lot of access to outdoor space. But if you're in the city or you're in the East End, not particularly close to somewhere like Victoria Park, then access to outside space really became one of the things that people wanted. So that was one of the drivers, probably the most important driver for us to getting out of the city. Was just being outside. London was eerie during lockdown, like going on cycle rides through an empty city. It was just a bit different to being outside. I'm a country boy. I was born backing onto fields, running through fields. So I think London was fun, but we just got to a stage where we needed to be out in the great outdoors again.
Because it must be 3 or 4 years ago that we first met at rugby, and I remember there being an enormous change in you. You could see it in the furrows in your brow disappearing when you didn't have to do, I can't remember how many hours you were spending a week in the car commuting and going between sites and things, and then things settled down, and then you've taken yet another move, which you know, seeing you while we were setting up the call, you seem incredibly relaxed and happy, and you've not only made the move in terms of living there, but you're carving out a career in the place that you've chosen to live, which is great.
Yeah, so when I was in Eastern Counties and living in London, I was doing 3 hours a day in the car, 110 miles, and it wasn't particularly sustainable. I was having burnout, as you say, like on the weekend, just absolutely knackered. Not great to be sat for that long either for me. And then when I was at Vistry, I was, what was I doing? I was sitting on the tube, and because I was in London, I was probably drinking more than I should be. And I was probably eating the wrong things. And really, I'm quite an active person. And the thing that I loved most during the graduate program at Barrett was being out on site and being active all day, being up and down scaffolds with different trades, in and out of houses, doing things. I'm not really estimating was a fantastic career, and I encourage anyone to get into it because there aren't enough estimators out there in development. But just being chained to my laptop wasn't really for my personality. Since moving out here and working for Woodchester, I've actually dropped 20 kilos just from being on my feet all day, every day. I'm walking up and down rows of vines, carrying different bits of vineyard equipment, driving tractors. Right now we're in the middle of our harvest period. The reason we've been able to make this call today is because it's pretty bloody miserable. It's tipping it down outside, and that's really not the best sort of conditions for picking grapes. So this has given us an opportunity to spend some time in the office doing all of the farm admin that sort of gets left to one side when you've got a harvest going on. But yeah, just being outside is fantastic for me. And being out here in the Cotswolds has really allowed that to take hold.
Well, Greg Chappell, it's a pleasure having you on. And it's great chatting about your career, about your property journey, about the construction industry, and indeed the English wine industry. So, Greg Chappell, this was Your Property World. I'm Will Mallard, and this is another episode of My Property World podcast. Greg Chappell, thank you.
Cheers, Will. Thank you very much.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together. Whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.